you for tuning in to the Mark and Acedo podcast, Anchor podcast. This is Mark and Acedo, and today's podcast is going to be a continuation of my series, My History of Music. This is going to be a continuation of August of 1966, because the event I'm going to talk about occurred in August of 1966. Basically, the information I gathered up for this initially was a bit long, and my podcast would have been over an hour, which the length I can go is an hour. I haven't been too long anyway, so I think I decided to do it separately, like a whole episode of this event separate. That being said, I added more stuff to it, so, and altogether now, the information I added up was over an hour, exactly, maybe an hour, I'm going to say an hour and 20 minutes, give or take. So I decided to split it up in two parts here. So what I'm doing is doing a podcast about the Beatles album Revolver. I'm going to do a track-by-track listing, and I'm discuss about each track the best I can. And then what I'm going to do is do like side one of the record, or side B, whatever you call it, part one. And part two will be side B. So part one, side one. Part two, side two. So this is part one again. Let's get started. So, the sources I use for this is Wikipedia and the Beatles Anthology book published in 2000. And I want to give props to Wikipedia because the information I gathered up is very, very informative. And thanks to Wikipedia, I wouldn't have had this information. I mean, I would have if I decided to do a thorough search of the sources. Because basically, Wikipedia is basically a website of sources, of things that gathered up from other sources. So, basically, it's the same, but wrapped into one, if you will. But yeah, that's the thing. I get props to Wikipedia for that information. Thank you. I'm giving you guys credit for this. Thank you. Because I'm going to read word for word almost in some of the same things I gathered up on this album from Wikipedia. So, and before I get started, too, I want to mention one thing, too. This is the first episode I'm doing this, so bear with me, please. This is the first time this is going on. I decided to put music through my episode, the whole episode. Not just doing the intro for the whole episode. And I'm going to change it up, too. I'm not going to play this one whole song for the whole episode. I'm going to change up the tunes for this. So, this is my first time doing this, so please bear with me. I apologize if it sounds like a bit choppy or offbeat or off or whatever it may be. Please forgive me. Okay, so let's get started. The Beatles Revolver, 1966. On August 5th, 1966, the Beatles released their seventh British album called Revolver. It was also released in the States, but with a few tracks missing from the album. The album is very experimental, very different than what they had done before, for the most part. It was unique, both musically and lyrically. And that being said, it's also my favorite Beatles album of all time, so, yeah. It's really worth checking out if you haven't heard it before. Let's see. John Lennon. One thing is for sure, the next LP is going to be very different. We wanted to have it so that there was no space between the tracks, just continuous, that they wouldn't wear it. Paul and I are very keen on this electronic music. You make it clinking a couple glasses together or with bleeps from the radio, and then you loop the tape to repeat the noises as intervals. Some people build up whole symphonies from it. It would have been better than the background music we had on the last film. All those silly bands, never again. Producer George Martin. Their ideas were beginning to become much more potent in the studio. They started telling me what they wanted and pressing me for more ideas and for more ways of translating those ideas into reality. With Revolver, you can hear that the boys were listening to lots of American records and saying, "Can we get this effect?" and so on. So they would want us to do radical things, but this time they'd shove in high EQ on mixing and for the brass. They wanted to have a really toppy sound and cut out all the bass. The engineers would sometimes wonder whether there should be that much EQ. It would go through the complete range of EQ on a disc, and if that wasn't enough, we'd put it through another range of EQ again, multiplied, and we get the most weird sound, which the Beatles liked and which obviously worked. George Harrison. EQ is equalization. When you want to add a bit of top or roll off a bit of bottom, it's bass, treble, and middle, but equalization is the posh way of saying it. I have a very high EQ, sometimes like 3,000 hertz. If I think too hard, my brain hurts. Paul McCartney. Originally, George Martin was the supreme producer in the sky, and we wouldn't even dare ask to go in the control room. But as things loosened up, we got invited in, and George gave us a bit of the control of the tools, and he let us have a go. George Harrison. George Martin had a strong role in our lives in the studio, but as we got more confidence, he and the others in EMI became more relaxed with us. I suppose as time went on, they believed more in our ability because it was obvious that we had success. They eased off on the schoolteacher approach. Also, George Martin had become more of our friend as well. We socialized with him. We gained more control each time that we got number one, and then we go back in the studio, we call our way up until we took over the store. John Lennon. We got knowledge of the studio. At first, I'd go in there and think, it's just like a tape recorder. I'm going to sing and play to you, and you're the one that knows about the tape recorder. Just put it on, and I'll sing. But as soon as you tell me, well, if we do that, we can get a little reverb on it, or if I stand over there, it'll sound different than if I stand here. You start learning all that. I used to play the first four albums one after the other to see the progression musically, and it was interesting. I got up to about Revolver, and it got too many. It would be too much listening time, but you could hear the progression as we learned about recording, and the techniques got refined. There was a change in the Beatles' music. Their sixth album from 1965, Rubber Soul album, was pretty evident of that. However, that change became much more evident on their seventh album, Revolver. Musical influences ranged from psychedelic, avant-garde, Middle Eastern Indian, classical, pop standard, and Baroque. Some of the avant-garde effects that were used were backmasking of instruments, sound effects, and various tape loops. Taxman, a George Harrison composition. This rocker was a protest against the higher level of progressive tax imposed in the United Kingdom by the Labour government of Harold Wilson, which saw the Beatles paying over 90% of their earnings to the Treasury. The song gave way to George Harrison as an emerging songwriter. George Harrison. It was in April of 1966 that we started recording Revolver. Taxman was on Revolver. I had discovered I was paying a huge amount of money to the taxman. You are so happy that you finally started earning money, and then you find out about tax. In those days, we paid 19 shillings and sixpence out of every pound. There were 20 shillings in the pound. It was super tax and surtax and tax. It was ridiculous. A heavy penalty to pay for making money. That was a big turnoff for Britain. Anybody who ever made any money moved to America or somewhere else. We got 25 quid a week in the early 60s when we were first with Brian Epstein, whom we played the clubs. But 25 quid a week each was quite good. My dad earned 10 pounds a week, so I was earning 2.5 times more than my father. Then we started earning much more, but Brian would keep it and pay us wages. He once tried to get us to sign a deal saying he would guarantee us £50 a week forever and he would keep the rest. We thought, no, we'll risk it, Brian. We'll risk everything. We'll risk earning, a bit more than the £50 a week. Paul McCartney. Taxman was very George. In business meetings, the solicitors and accountants would be explaining to us how things worked. We were very naive, as you can see by any of our business deals, and George would say, well, I don't want to pay tax, and they say you've got to like everyone else. And the more you make, the more they take. And George would reply, well, that's not very fair. They said, look, when you're dead, you're going to pay taxes. What? Death duties? So he came up with the great line, declare the pennies on your eyes, which was George's righteous indignation at the whole idea of having got here, made all this money and half of it was about to be removed by force. Ringo Starr. We were pissed off with the tax situation. We went into a one-man scheme where we paid a guy to go and live in the Bahamas and hold our money for us so it would be tax-free. And in the end, we had to bring in all the money back, pay the taxes on it, and pay this guy, so we might as well just have left it where it was. It was a scheme that someone had put forward with Brian, and we went for it. John Lennon. Tax Man was an anti-establishment tax song where we said, if you walk the street, they'll tax your feet. George wrote it, and I helped him with it. At the time, we weren't aware of the whole tax scene. I'm still not really aware of what goes on with taxes. We believe that if you earn it, you may as well keep it, unless there's a communal or communist or real Christian society. But while we are living in this, I protest against paying the government what I have to pay them. Eleanor Rigby, a Paul McCartney composition. The song's instrumentation consists only of a string quartet. Paul McCartney. I don't know whether poets think they have to experience things to write about them, but I can tell you our songs are nearly all imagination, 90% imagination. I don't think Beethoven was in a really wicked mood all the time. Paul McCartney again. I was never able to write out music, although I took lots of lessons when I was a kid. First off, I learned from the old lady who gave me the homework, and I tried it again when I was 16 with a young neighbor. But when he took me back to the five-finger exercises, I became bored because I was really writing little melodies like when I'm 64. So I go into the fun of it, and having to be pulled back into the discipline of it came too late. Later, when I written Eleanor Rigby, I tried learning with a proper bloke from the Guildhall School of Music, whom I was put on to by Jane Asher's mum, Margaret Elliott. Jane Asher was his girlfriend. An oboe teacher. Margaret Elliott was an oboe teacher. I didn't get on with him either. I went off him when I showed him Eleanor Rigby because I thought he'd be interested and he wasn't. I thought he'd be intrigued by the little time jumps. I wrote Eleanor Rigby when I was living in London and I had a piano in the basement. I used to disappear there and have a fiddle around, and when I was fiddling on a chord, some words came out. Picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. This idea of someone picking up rice after a wedding took it in the poignant direction into a lonely people direction. I had a bit of trouble with the name, and I'm always keen to get a name that sounds right. Looking at my old school photographs, I remembered the names, and they all work. James Stringfellow, Grace Pendleton, whereas when you read novels, it's all James Turnberry, and it's not real. So I was very keen to get a real sounding name for that tune and the whole idea. We were working with Eleanor Bronner on Help, and I liked the name Eleanor. It was the first time I'd ever been involved with that name. I saw Rigby in a shop in Bristol when I was walking around the city one evening. I thought, oh great, name, Rigby. It's real and yet a little bit exotic. So it became Eleanor Rigby. I thought I swear that I made up the name Eleanor Rigby like that. I remember quite distinctly having the name Eleanor, looking around for a believable surname and then wandering around the Docklands in Bristol and seeing the shop there. But it seems that up in Walton Cemetery, where I used to hang out a lot with John, there is a gravestone to an Eleanor Rigby. Apparently a few yards to the right, there's someone called Mackenzie. It was either coincidence Complete coincidence, excuse me, or in my subconscious. I suppose it was more likely in my subconscious because I will have been amongst those graves, knocking around with John and wandering through there. It was a sort of place we used to sunbathe, and we probably had a crappy fag in the graveyard. So subconscious it may be, but this is just bigger than me. I don't know the answer to that one. Coincidence is just a word that says two things coincided. We rely on it as an explanation, but it actually just names it. It goes no further than that, but as to why they happen together, there are probably far deeper reasons than our little brains can grasp. John Lennon. Eleanor Rigby was Paul's baby, and I helped with the education of the child. I'm Only Sleeping, a John Lennon composition. This psychedelic song features backwards guitar solos. One of the backwards guitar solos sound like someone yawning. Love You Too, a George Harrison composition. When you listen to this song, you may think the instrumentation is 100% Middle Eastern. Aside from sitar, Harrison plays a fuzz-tone lead guitar, as well as an acoustic guitar and a rhythm guitar. Ringo provides a tambourine. Anil Bagwat plays a tabla, and members of the Asian Music Circle play the tambura. A tabla is a Middle Eastern drum, and a tambura is a string instrument similar to a sitar, but bigger in length and is known to have a droning sound. George Harrison. I wrote Love You Too on the sitar because the sitar sounded so nice and my interest was getting deeper all the time. I wanted to write a tune that was specifically for the sitar. Also had a tabla part, and that was the first time I used a tabla player. Paul McCartney. The Indian sounds are definitely mainly George. We started off just hearing Indian music and listening to things, and we liked the drone idea because we've done that a bit of that kind of thing before. In songs before, excuse me. But George got very interested in it and went to a couple of Rabbi Shankar concerts. And then he met Rabbi and said, I was knocked out by him, just as a person. He's an incredible fellow. He's one of the greatest. He didn't know that George was serious about it. And so when he found out George was serious, he was knocked out too. So the two of them were having a great time. And that's how we brought Indian sounds on it. It's nice to start bridging the two kinds of music because we just started off in a very simple way. And then this album's got a bit better. It's a little bit more like Indian music. And it helps people to understand it too. Because it's very hard to understand. But once you can get into it, it's the greatest. John Lennon. It's amazing that this is so cool. Don't the Indians appear cool to you? This music is thousands of years old and makes me laugh. The British going over there and telling them what to do. Quite amazing. George Harrison. To me, it's the only really great music now. And that makes Western 3 or 4 beat type stuff seem somehow dead. You can get so much more out of it if you are prepared really to concentrate and listen. I hope more people will try to dig it. Love You Too is partly a love song to Harrison's wife, Patty Boyd, which, while also incorporating philosophical concepts inspired by his experimentation with the hallucinogenic drug LSD. In the context of its release, the song served as one of the first examples of the Beatles expressing the ideology aligned with that of the emerging counterculture. Love You Too has been hailed as by musicologists and critics as groundbreaking in its presentation of a non-Western musical form to rock audiences, particularly with regard to authenticity and avoidance of parody. Author Jonathan Gold describes the song's slow sitar introduction as one of the most brazenly exotic acts of stylistic experimentation ever heard on a popular LP. Here, There, and Everywhere, the Paul McCartney composition. The Beach Boys, God Only Knows, gave Paul the inspiration for this song. the Yellow Submarine, Paul McCartney and John Lennon. Paul sung mainly with John helping out a bit. Ringo takes the lead vocals on this one. Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones and Scottish singer Donovan provide background vocals and sound effects. Paul McCartney. I remember lying in bed one night in that moment before you falling asleep, that little twilight moment when a silly idea comes into your head and thinking of Yellow Submarine. We all live in a Yellow Submarine. I quite like children's things. I like children's minds and imagination, so it didn't seem uncool to me to have a pretty surreal idea with that was also a children's idea. I thought also with Ringo being so good with children, a knockout uncle type, it might not be a bad idea for him to have a children's song rather than a very serious song. He wasn't that keen on singing. John Lennon. Donovan helped out with the lyrics. I helped with the lyrics too. We virtually made the track come alive in the studio, but based on Paul's inspiration, Paul's idea, Paul's title, so I count it as a Paul song. George Harrison. Yellow Submarine was written by Paul and John, but even in the early days they were writing larger portions on their own. Then one would help the other would finish it off. But that was because that became more apparent later on. Ringo Starr. I don't actually know where they got the idea for it. I just felt it was a really interesting track for me to do. I've been doing a lot of covers. At the time, I did either covers or something they wrote specifically for me. It usually happened that we'd be willing to an album, and we all knew that I'd be doing a number somewhere, usually about three quarters of the way through, and either I say, "Have you got a song?" or they say, "We've got this for you," or we haven't got anything. Is there anything you want to do? So through the years, we did the Carl Perkins numbers and the Buck Owens numbers. Then it ended up that mainly John and Paul would write songs for me. At that time, it was hard to bring your own songs in when you had Lennon McCartney. It used to be a bit of a joke, really. I would bring in the songs that I'd written, and they'd all be rolling on the floor laughing because I'd rewritten an old standard. I was great at rewriting Jerry Lewis songs. It was me getting my craft together. At first, George went through the same problems presenting his songs that I went through, but that didn't last long, and then he started coming up with great songs. Taxman was great. It's not a bad opening act for Revolver, is it? George Harrison. I didn't have too many songs. I'd always had a couple of ones I was working on or thinking about, and in the later years, I didn't have a huge backlog. But in the mid-60s, I didn't have too many. The Beatles dedicated their June 1st session to adding the song sound effects. For this, Martin drew on his experience as a producer of comedy records for Beyond the Fringe and members of the Goons. The band invited guests to participate, including Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, Harrison's wife Patty Boyd, Marianne Faithfull, Beatles road managers Mal Evans and Neil Aspinall, and Alf Bicknell, the band's driver. The studio store cupboard was sourced for items such as chains, bells, whistles, hooters, a tin bath, and a cash till. Although effects were added throughout the track, they were heavily edited for the release recording. The sound of the ocean waves enters at the start of the second verse and continues through the first chorus. Harrison created this effect by swirling water around a bathtub. On the third verse, the party atmosphere was evoked through a combination of Jones clinking glasses together and blowing on an ocarina. Snatches of excited chatter, Boyd's high-pitched shrieks, Bicknell rattling chains, and tumbling coins to fill the two-bar gap following the line, and the band begins to play. Martin and engineer Jeff Emmerich used a recording of a brass band from EMI's tape library. They disguised the piece by splicing up the tape copy and rearranging the melody. The recording includes a sound effects solo over the non-singing verse designed to convey the submarine's operation. Lennon blew through a straw into a pan of water to create a bubbling effect. Other sounds imitate the whirring of machinery, a ship's bell, hatches being slammed, chains hitting metal, and finally the submarine submerging. Lennon used the studio's echo chamber to shout out commands and responses such as, "Full speed ahead, Mr. Boatswain." From a hallway just outside the studio, Starr yelled, "Cut the cable." Gold describes the section as a goonish concerto, consisting of sound effects drawn from the collective unconscious of a generation of schoolboys raised on films about the war beneath the seas. According to Eckert, the effects are an especially rich example of how sound effects can function topically in psychedelia, since they serve a storytelling role and further the song's naval and oceanic narrative and its nostalgic qualities. The latter, he says, is due to the tremor recalled radio broadcast not only as a contemporary experience but also as an emblem of the near distant past. And he also sees the effects in cinematic in their presentation as a coherent sonic scenario, one that can be diegetic in the imagined series of filmic events. In the final verse, Lennon echoes Starr's lead vocal, delivering the lines in a manner that musicologist Walter Everett terms manic. Keen to the sound as if he were singing underwater, Lennon tried recording the part with a microphone encased in a condom, and at Emmerich's suggestion, submerged inside a bottle filled with water. This proved ineffective, and Lennon instead sang with the microphone plugged into a Vox guitar amplifier. All the participants and available studio staff sang the closing choruses, argumenting that and the vocals recorded by the Beatles on May 26th. Evans also played a marching bass drum over the section. When the overdubs were finished, Evans led everybody in a line around the studio doing the conga dance while banging on the drum strapped to his chest. Martin later told Alan Smith of the NME that the band loved every minute of the session, and that was more like the things I've done with the Goons and Peter Sellers than a typical Beatles recording. Music critic Tim Riley characterizes Yellow Submarine as one big Spike Jones charade. In 1965-66, Paul McCartney grew a passion for the surreal, psychedelic, avant-garde stuff that was happening. This includes music and artwork. When he introduced John to the surreal stuff, John fell in love with it. When it comes to the surreal stylings they each had, they were different, but they worked. She Said, She Said, a John Lennon composition. Inspired from the LSD trip that Lennon experimented in 1965, the Beatles were hanging out with the Byrds in Los Angeles at a swimming pool. John was tripping on LSD. Actor Peter Fonda, who also was on LSD, was present and kept coming up to John and kept saying, "I know what it's like to be dead." John used that line for a song, but changed the sex of the person saying it. He said, to she said, she said. He was very uncool, as John explained in a 1980 interview about Peter Fonda. "We didn't want to hear about that. We were on an acid trip, and the sun was shining, and the girls who were dancing, and the whole thing was beautiful in the 60s. And this guy, who I really didn't know, he hadn't made Easy Rider or anything, kept coming over wearing shades, saying, 'I know what it's like to be dead.' And we kept leaving him because he was so boring. It was scary, you know, when you're flying high and whispers, 'I know what it's like to be dead, man.'" And John Lennon's personal comment about She Said, She Said. "She Said, She Said was mine. It's an interesting track. The guitars are great on it. That was written after an acid trip in LA during a break in the Beatles tour where we were having fun with the Byrds and a lot of girls." And that's it for side one of the record album Revolver. That's all I have. have for this episode. I hope the music thing worked. It was kind of different. I was kind of trying to figure out interesting songs to play during my little intervals or whatever. But I hope it worked. If it sounds choppy, I apologize. It's experimentation. It makes sense because we're talking about an experimental album. How about that? But anyway, this is all I have for today's episode. And the next time we'll do side 2 of Revolver. Yeah, thank you and have a good one. Bye.